Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, substituting today for Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
Yeah.
Frank Horgan?
Yeah.
I've read about you, seen photos. You were JFK's favorite. Dallas. What happened to you that day?
And this time, he'll be ready.
I see you, Frank. I see you standing over the grave of another dead president.
That's not gonna happen.
That's a clip from the classic 1993 Clint Eastwood movie, In the Line of Fire. It's the story of a Secret Service agent who, haunted by his failure to stop the 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy, is determined to redeem himself and ends up thwarting another assassination attempt on another American president. The film captures the core ethos of the Secret Service: to protect presidents, former presidents, and presidential candidates, as well as others it is assigned to guard at all costs. So how exactly did the Secret Service come catastrophically close to a complete failure of its mission last Sunday in Butler, Pennsylvania? Especially, as we've now learned, there was supposed to have been an enhanced security posture due to intelligence reporting about an Iranian plot to kill former President Trump. We'll talk to somebody unusually well qualified to discuss these and other issues about the Butler rally, John Cohen, the former chief of intelligence at the Department of Homeland Security, who's had years of experience working with the Secret Service, on this episode of Spy Talk. John Cohen, welcome to Spy Talk.
It's great to be with you, Mike.
So as I mentioned, you're the perfect guest to assess what happened here in Butler, Pennsylvania. You were chief of intelligence at Homeland Security. You worked with the Secret Service for years. As you look at everything we've learned at what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, the failure to secure that roof from which the shooter was perched, the failure to communicate the many warnings that were coming in to the Secret Service. Tell us, what leaps out at you? How do you assess what the Secret Service did and did not do here?
Well, let me first start by saying you're right. I've worked with the Secret Service for years. I worked with them when I was a local police officer. I worked with them on protective security details. I've planned these types of operations. I've overseen these types of operations. They're a great organization. There are men and women that work there that are highly professional. But I got to say, you know, just based on what we've learned thus far, there are, I think, legitimate questions. I fully understand that the best preparations, the best training can fall apart as a crisis operation begins to unfold. But I think we need to take a hard look at a number of factors relating to the attempted assassination of a former president. We need to look at what was known before the event. Was there any intelligence, whether it was possessed by local officials or the federal government? that the risk to the former president was at a higher level than traditional, and it's already at a high level just by the nature that he's the former president. We're also in a higher, a more volatile threat environment, so that should have resulted in additional cautions. We need to assess whether there were appropriate communication capabilities in place, whether the physical security plan was sufficient based on the threat. Real questions about why that rooftop wasn't better secured. It's common practice that if you have a position such as that rooftop, which is elevated, which is in a direct line of sight with a protectee who may be giving a speech, you sweep it and secure it. That doesn't seem to have been done. Real questions about whether suspicious activities that were being reported by attendees or even law enforcement personnel were found their way to the folks on the president's detail so that it could be factored into consideration of whether his arrival at the location should have been delayed. And then there's questions about what happened after those shots were fired. The rule of thumb is that at the first firing, you put the protectee in a position of safety. You try to shield him or her from the gunfire. But as soon as you can, you get that person out of there. You don't wait for them to get their shoes. You don't wait for them to wave at the crowd. If you have to, you pick them up by the belt and you carry them to their armored vehicle and you get that vehicle out of there. That did not seem to occur rapidly. Now, there may be legitimate reasons for that, but those are the types of questions that need to be looked at, and they need to be looked at quickly because we now have a situation where there's already distrust in government. There's already, division across our populace, and we're beginning to see a significant amount of online conspiracy theories being shared. And that adds to the volatility of what was already a dangerous threat environment.
And not to mention the finger pointing that seems to be going on now between the Secret Service and local law enforcement, in which, they're each is trying to point the finger at the other for what looks like a catastrophic failure to secure that roof. Kimberly Cheadle, the director of the Secret Service, saying, that roof was outside the Secret Service's perimeter, and it was the job of local law enforcement to secure it. The locals are saying that they didn't have the manpower to do that. I'm looking at today's Washington Post. Richard Goldfinger, the district attorney in Butler County, said the Secret Service was, quote, informed that the local police department did not have the manpower to assist with security at that building. Now, once you hear that, I would think that, alarm bells should have been going off within the Secret Service and local police about how that building was going to be secured.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the safety and security of a Secret Service protectee, in this case, the president, rests squarely on the shoulders of the Secret Service. That's their mission. They are responsible. And while I understand that the Secret Service does not have unlimited resources, while I understand that these types of events require multi-agency collaboration, while I understand that roles and responsibilities are organized across these different organizations. Local police are responsible for certain things and Secret Service may be responsible for others. When it comes to the security of the protectee, that is solely the responsibility or primarily the responsibility of the service. And that includes if a vulnerability or an emerging threat is identified that impacts places that protectee at higher risk. So whether there were resource constraints or not, if that roof is identified as a point of vulnerability, as a place where a potential assassin could locate themselves and take a shot at their protectee, then it's at the end of the day, the finger pointing is of no value. It's the responsibility of the service to make sure that vulnerability is mitigated.
And then you put on top of that, the reports we've got that a number of people in the crowd were alerting local authorities to this suspicious character, Thomas Brooks, who was the shooter. And what communications were going on among local authorities, the Secret Service? I mean, this guy was flagged early on, you know, over an hour before, as suspicious. And then there are multiple reports, including right up to seconds before, there's a shooter on the roof. There's a shooter on the roof. There's a man on the roof. You know, we have not seen or heard what the communications were with going on in Butler at that moment, but one would think there ought to have been a immediate scramble.
Well, that is a question that investigators will have to take a look at, because, again, it depends. You know, what I would like to see, or what I'm waiting to see, is what was reported. What were the behavior? What were the behaviors that this individual was exhibiting that led to people in the crowd and even others in law enforcement to become concerned about him? What were the suspicious activities? What was communicated? How was that communication relayed? You know, you have multiple agencies on different radio frequencies operating in the same geographic location. So a basic part of planning involves making sure there's ways to integrate those communications, whether it's through patching devices or whether through it's a command center. So what should have happened is, if there are concerns about an individual in the crowd or adjacent to the location, those concerns should be communicated to the command post. The command post should be making sure that the detail protecting the former president are aware, so that a decision could be made, or consideration could be made for potentially delaying his arrival. There should be a plan that should be executed in order to have somebody locate that individual and contact them, interview them, assess whether they're a risk. And that the results of that interaction should be conveyed back to the command post so operational decisions can be made. So we'll have to see what was communicated by the crowd, what was observed by law enforcement. Was this person located and contacted? There is a period of time, I think in some reporting I've seen, it could be as much as 20 minutes, where attention began to focus on a suspicious person who was acting oddly around the mags, who was acting in, you know, oddly around the building that the, you know, that eventually became the location of the from the shooter used to fire the shots. We'll just have to see what was actually communicated and what was conveyed. The other reporting that's if it turned out to be true, would be concerning, is that apparently the individual was spotted on the roof prior to the former president taking the stage. I'd like to see, I'll be interested to see what communication took place regarding that, because again, it's not uncommon for there to be tactical delays, you know, put in place to prevent the protectee from going into a position of greater vulnerability until such time that the security professionals and law enforcement professionals are satisfied the threat's been mitigated.
You know, when you mentioned different communications channels, it reminds me of some of the investigations after 9/11, where in New York City, the FBI, federals were not on the same communication channels as the fire department and the police department. And all that was supposed to have been fixed. I remember that was one of the main recommendations of the 9/11 commission. And, you know, shouldn't that have been applied nationwide by the Secret Service? The same issues presented themselves.
Well, 22 plus years have passed since 9/11. You're right. This was one of the primary findings by the 9/11 Commission, that the lack of radio system interoperability impeded the response to the World Trade Center that day and impeded the response to the Pentagon. And it's been a longstanding issue. We have mostly resolved those issues. There's a number of ways you can resolve them. Like I said, you can put people on the same radio frequency by sharing radios. You can use interconnecting technologies, which will link different frequencies. But most commonly in an operation like this, it's as simple as having a command post where you have representatives from all the agencies that are operating within the within that event. And you are relaying to people information that can then be used for tactical or operational activities. So that'll be a central question. What was reported? What was conveyed to the command center? What was conveyed to the participants in this security operation, whether it's the inner circle, you know, the detail protecting the former president, the Secret Service agents traveling with the former president to the venue, or the local law enforcement people? Were people assigned to locate this individual? Were people assigned to interact with him and assess whether he's a threat? It would seem to me once he's observed on the roof, you don't have the protectee go to the stage until you know for sure that that person is not a threat. That to me seems like a very basic operational tactic.
But that's not what happened here.
It does not appear that that's what happened. So we have to understand why.
You know, we are taping this on Thursday. It's been, you know, this event was Saturday, and we've gotten very few answers. Starting with on Sunday, President Biden said that he was ordering a independent outside review of what the Secret Service did here. As of now, we have heard nothing more about who's conducting that review. There have been no briefings for the public by the Secret Service. There's a number of interviews that Director Cheadle has given. I'm going to play one for you in a moment. But very few answers five days after that shooting, and which, as you mentioned, is fueling all sorts of conspiracy theories here. I mean, just talk about the failure by the Secret Service, the White House, the Department of Homeland Security to address all these questions that people are asking right now.
Yeah, we've learned, you know, through some very tough lessons over the last decade, you know, whether it's school shootings or mass casualty attacks, or other crisis incidents, that the most important thing from a communications perspective for the for local authorities and federal authorities to do is to get information out to the public quickly. That's even more important today. We're in the midst of a threat environment where this country is highly divided, highly polarized. There's a lot of distrust. You know, there's distrust of government institutions. We have foreign adversaries that you know, intelligence services and terrorist groups that will, and even domestic violent extremist organizations that will seek to exploit circumstances such as this to further exacerbate this highly volatile threat environment we find ourselves in. This assassination attempt was not the first act of political violence in the current threat environment. And if things don't change significantly, it won't be the last. And I say all of that only to echo what you just said, which is it is critically important that the federal government get information out quickly to the public, if for no other reason than to provide accurate information to the public. So those that are being barraged with conspiracy theories and disinformation aren't not only relying on that as the information that they use to make judgments about this. As it relates to the independent investigation, I think that was inevitable. I mean, again, for the reasons I...
Yeah, but John, we're 5 days past the president saying he was ordering that, and nothing about who is conducting it, what actions they're taking. I mean, that leaps out at me as, wait a second here. Why hasn't the White House moved more quickly? Why hasn't the Department of Homeland Security moved more quickly to assure the public that a real investigation has taken place?
Well, we learned yesterday, I think, that the Inspector General has launched a probe into this. But to your point, I would like to have seen quicker action where a person who was going to lead the investigation was identified. The investigation needs to be done rapidly. It needs to be done thoroughly. It needs to be done, and the results have to be communicated by someone who will be trusted by all parts of the ideological spectrum here. It cannot be viewed as a whitewash, and it needs to be transparent, and it needs to be done quickly. It needs to be done very quickly.
And the fact that it hasn't so far?
It's troubling. I would like to have seen a better communications response to this incident than we've seen. I'll just leave it at that.
We'll now take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back. So in the wake of the incident, Secretary Mayorkas said he has 100% confidence in Secret Service Director Cheadle, who only took that job a couple of years ago after being chief of security at Pepsi-Cola, had a long career in the Secret Service. She has said she's proud of the actions that her agents took that day, which seems like a pretty astonishing thing to say in view of everything we've learned. There are calls for her from Congress and others, including the esteemed editor of Spy Talk, Jeff Stein, for her to resign. What say you?
I mean, you know me, I've known you for decades. I am a law enforcement person. I want to see all the facts before I jump to conclusions. I was more than willing to say that the officers who responded to the Uvalde incident failed and that there were major glaring holes in their tactical response. And depending on what we learn about some of the issues we've been discussing, I'll be more than willing to call it like it is with this. There are a lot of questions. Those questions need to be answered, need to be answered quickly. I think it is unhelpful for those in, you know, public personalities, whether they be in government or in the media, to jump to any conclusions on this, as it is for anything else, and to convey conspiracy theories. The idea that we have some in public office saying that this was, you know, orchestrated by the Trump administration, or public figures saying that this was orchestrated by the Trump administration, the Trump campaign,
by the Biden administration,
or the Biden administration, is unhelpful, right? I mean, look, you and I have talked about this in the past. We often hear calls for vast government conspiracies, you know, the deep state. I question whether, and having served in government often over the last 40 years, there's a certain level of competency that needs to exist for deep state conspiracies to actually be able to happen. And sometimes incompetency is described as a conspiracy. But we need to wait and see. And I think there are some serious questions, you know, that could impact the director's longevity in her position.
That's a very artful way of saying that the facts may dictate that she has to resign.
Well, look, here's the bottom line, Mike. I mean, seriously, we just had a former president of the United States, a candidate for that office again, almost assassinated at an event, and literally inches prevented that assassination from being successful. Action by those snipers prevented potentially other people in the crowd from being killed. This is not a little deal, right? You know, we talk to our kids about big deals and little deals. This is a big deal. And if it turns out, and I feel very comfortable saying this, if it turns out that there were issues with the planning, the preparation, and the tactical execution of the protective response, then people should lose their jobs. Because if this assassination would have been successful, it would have poured incredible amount of gasoline on already what is a fire of a threat environment.
You know, we were talking about all the unanswered questions that the Secret Service or Homeland Security have not addressed. Among them is who was on the scene for the Secret Service in charge of the planning for this event and the supervision of the event. We've heard nothing from any of them, how they made, what decisions they did, what factored into the questions about whether to secure the roof or be inside the building or an adjacent building. We still don't know. I'm just astonished that there, you know, nobody from the Secret Service, other than Cheadle, who's given these few interviews where she says very little, has come out to brief the public.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that's a fair observation. I mean, there's the detail leader for the former president's detail. He's responsible for the movements of the president. There would have been a senior Secret Service special agent who would be responsible for the event. There's the advanced teams who are responsible for scouting the events. There's the senior officials from the state or local agencies that are on scene. I know that Pennsylvania State Police were there, local police were there. There would have been, you know, people responsible for the movements. Ultimately, there is somebody who was in charge of this entire event.
We don't know who that is right now.
I have not heard. I don't think they've announced who that is. We also don't know, and I haven't even heard people asking. One of the things that's really interesting about this, and the listeners may not be aware of this, is that very often the role of the service can be they can advise to the campaign, or if you're in government, they can advise to the staff of the secretary or the protectee security measures they would like to employ, and their suggestions can be ignored. So a question that should be asked is, what was conveyed to the former president? What was conveyed to the campaign, to the service? Like, for example, I would want to know, was there a recommendation to delay his arrival until issues of concern could be resolved? Were those recommendations ignored? So those are the types of questions that we still need answers to. And again, look, I'm more than happy to be very direct in raising concerns about decision-making and operational efficacy. But at the same time, we need to know all the facts. And I'm not ready at this point yet to completely throw the service under the bus. I think they've got a lot to explain, and they need to get it explained pretty quickly, or the situation is going to spiral out of control even more so than it is today. And it's pretty much out of control.
Yes, it is. I don't know if you saw the clips of Cheadle was at the Republican convention last night, I gather, and was being harassed by multiple U.S. senators. In fact, she was being followed around from senators demanding answers, which she was not prepared to give. You talked about the enhanced threat environment. And when we talked the other day, you mentioned this is as dangerous as you've seen in many years. We know that there was U.S. intelligence reporting about an Iranian plot to assassinate Donald Trump that the White House National Security Council was tracking, asking the Secret Service to track. So it was serious enough for them to get involved. Tell us about the nature of the threat environment right now, and whether that should have led to a dramatically enhanced security posture.
So I've been, as I mentioned to you the other day, I've been working for the past couple of years now closely with state and local law enforcement leaders, election officials, and others regarding potential threats during this election cycle. And I'll tell you what I've told them. This is the most dangerous threat environment that I've experienced in the 40 plus years that I've been involved in law enforcement and Homeland Security. And I say that for a few reasons. One, we're an incredibly divided and polarized nation. There's a subset of our country that views those who disagree with them not as people who disagree, but as the enemy. We have a growing number of people in this country who believe violence is an appropriate way to express their political views or to express their disagreement with the political or public policy views of others. Violence is an acceptable way to express their disagreement with government, or to express their disagreement with the lifestyle or political beliefs of those in our community. And we've actually experienced violence by people that has been directed at government officials, law enforcement, people who are targeted because of their religious views, their ethnicity, their political views, their sexual or gender identity, their immigration status. Thirdly, these acts of violence are being fueled by an online and media ecosystem that's saturated with conspiracy theories and other content that's purposely placed there by foreign intelligence services, such as those from Russia and Iran, by foreign terrorist groups, by domestic violent extremists, and they place that content there to exploit divisive issues in our society and to inspire and incite acts of violence, demonstrations. They seek to destabilize our society, undermine confidence in government. We're seeing a resurgence of foreign terrorist threats, more activity by groups not only such as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, but from Hezbollah, Hamas. They're employing cyber attacks. They're using information operations. They are seeking to facilitate kinetic operations. they're seeking to exploit the southern border and introduce operatives into the U.S. And I would just finally say that for countries like Russia and Iran, this is an existential election. Russia's military survival depends on the election going in a way that's favorable to their geopolitical objectives. So, you know, yes, for those factors that I just described, this is a highly complex, volatile, and dynamic threat environment. And events that occur in the digital world, in foreign lands, have a direct impact on the safety and security of communities in the United States.
What worries you the most?
I worry, going back to our conversation, that if we don't navigate this situation regarding the attempted assassination of the former president, we will continue to see, or we will see increased levels of political violence directed at not only government officials and election officials, but other elements of our society. The stuff we're seeing online, the content we're seeing online being placed there by, you know, Russian-linked organizations and domestic voices, but also public figures, they're all mimicking the same narratives, and they're being consumed. And we need to navigate this time period very, very carefully.
When you are itemizing the multiple threats, you mentioned one that obviously has political implications, and that is the idea that foreign terrorist organizations or foreign actors are seeking to exploit the southern border and bring in terrorists who could commit heinous acts against American civilians. Obviously, that's a contentious issue. Tell us what we know about that, how extensive that is. Is this part of some concerted plan by ISIS-K or some other foreign actors to do this? It's obviously a very important question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what people should understand is that there are easier ways for a terrorist to get into this country than trying to, you know, than landing someplace in Central America and taking the, you know, the difficult journey through Mexico and showing up at some place across the border or at the border. And we have actually put in place some pretty extensive capabilities that allow us to identify terrorist operatives as they seek to enter the U.S. Or the region, and then travel to the U.S. And our screening and vetting of people who are encountered at the border has dramatically improved. But as we just heard, several weeks ago in reporting about, I think it was 8 individuals who were arrested by the FBI subsequent to their coming in, from what I've heard, those individuals wouldn't have showed up, didn't, when they were encountered, were screened and vetted, and there was no derogatory information in any U.S. holdings, and intelligence was captured, was identified later, or was collected later, that led to their identification and subsequent arrest. So it is a vulnerability, but it is a vulnerability that CBP and our intelligence community are aware of and have taken great strides to mitigate. But when you have, you know, the numbers of people, the sheer numbers of people presenting at the southern border or crossing at the southern border, you have to understand it's a vulnerability, which is why, again, you know, you talk about this as a political issue. I look at it as an operational issue. You know, are there humanitarian issues at the southern border that need to be addressed? Do we need more screening, people who are doing screening, vetting, adjudicating, and transporting and housing of these people? Do we need to be concerned about the potential that criminals and terrorists and intelligence operatives may seek to exploit the conditions at the southern border and surreptitiously gain entry. Yes. Yeah, we do, which is why CBP wants more resources, which is why we need to not just look at these issues, whether it's the assassination attempt or the operational conditions at the southern border, through strictly political lenses, and look at it from an operational perspective. So what really worries me at night right now is that we understand the threat. There are people who are more than willing to do the work that's necessary to address the threat. But the polarized political environment that we are experiencing right now not only is contributing to the threat, but it's impeding our ability to address the threat.
You were at Homeland Security for, I think, the first 2 years of the Biden administration as chief of intelligence. Now, that was the period when the surge in border crossings ramped up and became the political problem it's become. Were these issues and the potential security implications of a surge in border crossings, were they on your radar at the time? And did you try to alert people to the potential implications?
Yes, and yes. And it's you brought this up. It's important to understand, why was there a surge? There was a surge that, because beginning about 2019, we started seeing a significant increase in persons from across the globe, not just from Central and South America, but from across the globe, relocating to Central and South America with the intent to come to the United States. We began seeing dramatic increases in encounters at the southern border in 2019 and into early 2020. While the flow into the United States was restricted with COVID, due to COVID, people were still fleeing violence, disease, economic insecurity from around the globe and traveling to Central and South America. So while entry into the United States was restricted because of COVID, the people traveling to Central and South America to come to the United States continued. And the population, we called it the diaspora population, in Central and South America, people grew from 1 million to 4 million to, estimates before I left, were 6 million people. We knew that some of those people were within hours of the southern border, and we knew that other parts of that population were within days or weeks of the southern border. And we anticipated that as soon as the COVID restrictions were lifted, because they were going to have to be lifted legally, they would begin moving to the southern border. We also understood that human smugglers were leveraging the power of the internet to mobilize not just 10 or 20 people at a time to present at the border, but thousands of people at the border. It was a technique that we had not seen before, and it was a technique that we needed to develop an operational plan to address. So when the COVID restrictions were lifted, that's when you started seeing these massive numbers beginning to move. But what people failed to remember is that the conditions that actually led to this surge in 21 and 22 began in 2019. And at the same time that those numbers were increasing, the resources that were put in place to be able to address those conditions were diminished by the prior administration. So look, the conditions at the southern border were really bad. They're getting better now. But to sit here and to solely say, oh, well, this entire massive population of people just suddenly appeared in 2021 is just inconsistent with the facts. And we had an analytic team that was focused expressly on understanding those conditions, identifying mechanisms to anticipate when we would see large-scale movements. And we worked closely with not only CBP and others on the operational side, but the intelligence community, to make sure that we had an accurate understanding of the conditions, the movements, and what would happen. So before I left, I actually briefed White House officials, along with Secretary Mayorkas, about what we were anticipating at the southern border once the COVID restrictions were lifted, based on the conditions that I just described to you.
Did you ask them to take steps?
Yeah, Secretary Mayorkas laid out an extensive operational plan to address these issues. But as we talked about earlier, it takes resources. As we sit here today, those resources still have not been allocated by Congress.
So last question, for all the concerns you have about the foreign actors fueling these security threats, when you look at the guy who was the shooter, Thomas Crooks, 20 years old, an American citizen living in Butler, doesn't seem to have had any affiliations that the FBI has been able to identify yet as part of any, you know, militia group, terrorist group, whatever, your classic lone wolf. And that was the shooter who almost killed the former president.
Yep, you make an important point. The former president of the United States, the current Republican nominee, was almost assassinated by a troubled young person who, at some point, because of his personal condition, his life experience, turned to violence. And, you know, investigators may never really determine a single or precise motive for why he did this. It's likely, based on what we've learned so far, going to be a combination of mental health issues, a blend of ideological beliefs that don't fit into traditional definitional categories, and a sense of personal grievance. By the way, that's the same combination that we've seen in almost every school shooter and every mass casualty attack perpetrator over the last 10 years. But what's also becoming apparent to me, as somebody who has studied mass shootings now and been involved in developing operational responses to preventing them, for over a decade, is that there were warning signs. There were warning signs that were observed by family members, by people who interacted with this individual. The question is, did they recognize him, and were they reported, and was any action taken?
Right. John, I want to thank you. Circling back to an issue we raised before, the fact that we still don't know who's heading up the outside investigation into the Secret Service's lapses here. Spy Talk would like to formally nominate you in the absence of anybody else having come forward. But we will... we will see if the White House listens. But anyway, thanks a lot for your insights. Really appreciate it.
As always, it's great talking to you. Look forward to doing it again.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Jeff Stein will be back next week.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.